ज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्याज्ञलञ्जनशलाकय चाक्षुर्निर्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः। वाञ्छाकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्यैव च प्रतिदानं पवनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः। नाम श्रेष्ठं मनुमापि सच्चिपुत्रम् अत्रा स्वरूपं रूपं तस्याग्रजमुरूपुरीं माधुरीं गोष्ठावतीं राधाकुण्डं गिरिवरं महोराधिकमधावसं प्राप्तु यस्या प्रतीत्तकृपाया श्रीगुरुं तं नतोऽस्मि। निखिलाश्रुतिमौलिरत्नमालदिति निराजितपदपङ्कजन्त आजिमुक्तकुलैरुपश्यामनं परितस्त्वं हरिणं संश्रयामि। अनर्पितचरीं चिरकरुणयावतीर्णाकलहं समार्पयितुमुन्नतोज्ज्वलरासं स्वभक्तिश्रियं हरिपुरता सुन्दरद्युतिकदम्बसन्दीपितः सदा हृदये कन्दरे स्फुरतो वासचिनन्दना। लालिनीशक्तिस्वरूपाय गौरङ्गसुहृदाय च भक्तशक्तिप्रदनाय गदाधर नमस्तु ते। रासघनमहानमूर्तिं विचित्रकिलिमहोत्सवोल्लासितं राधाचरणविलोदितं रुचिराश्रिकन्दं हरिं वन्दे वृन्दावनेश्वरितवैभवपदारविन्दं प्रेमामृतैकमखरुन्दरशोघपूर्णं हरिद्यर्पितं मधुपतेर्स्मरतापमग्रं निर्वापयत्परमशीतलमाश्रयामि। भक्त्यभिहीनायापराधलक्षैः क्षिप्तश्चाकमादितरङ्गमाद्यम् कृपामयि त्वं शरणं प्रपानं वृन्देन्मस्ते चरणारविन्दं वृन्देन्मस्ते चरणारविन्दं। श्रीसचिनन्दन गौरहरि की जय। श्रीहरि नाम प्रभु की जय। गौर भक्तवृंद की जय। गौर प्रेमानंद हरि हरि बोल। प्रणाम टू ऑल ऑफ यू, टू ईच वन ऑफ यू। ग्रीटिंग्स फ्रॉम श्री आनंद आश्रम। द लास्ट फ्यू डेज हियर इन नॉर्थ कैरोलिना बिफोर कंटिन्यूइंग ट्रेवल्स टू नेदरलैंड्स एंड अ फ्यू अदर प्लेसेस वेयर आई लुक फॉरवर्ड टू बी ब्लेस्ड बाई द कंपनी ऑफ मैनी ऑफ यू, नॉट टू से मोस्ट ऑफ यू। सो हियर वी आर अगेन, वेलकम बैक टू आवर वीकली कम्युनियन, वीकली सत्संग, वीकली अटेम्प्ट टू शो अप विदाउट हैविंग अ कंट्रोल ओवर द आउटकम, व्हिच इज इन इटसेल्फ एन एक्ट ऑफ डीप करेज एंड वल्नरेबिलिटी। सो आई कंग्रेचुलेट यू इन एडवांस जस्ट फॉर शोइंग अप, एंड आई एम ब्लेस्ड बाय योर फ्रेंडशिप एंड प्रेजेंस टुडे, द गिफ्ट ऑफ योर प्रेजेंस व्हिच इज इन इटसेल्फ अ ह्यूज गिफ्ट, नॉट टू बी Never to be underestimated how much we can bless each other by sincere presence and bearing witness to the unfolding, to the blooming of everyone's journey. That in itself is a blessing, so let's not be falsely humble and say, no, I cannot give you blessings, I cannot bless anyone. We have been blessed, so we can give blessings by way of extending the blessings we have received. So as usual, if you have anything you would like to share, you are invited to raise your digital hand, whether it is a question, an exploration, a quest, a doubt, whatever. Whatever we can put at the center of the table, sit together around it, try to explore it from different angles, and trying to gain a comprehensive grasp of whatever we need to grasp today. It's just one point in the infinite, but that point may be enough for the day. But still, we need to be exhaustive in how we are trying to honor that, to honor reality today. So you can raise your digital hand, or if you don't know how to do so or prefer to send something via written message, you're free to do so. And I'm seeing a few raised hands so far. Shyam Mukund, Hari Vyasadev, and Prabhu Samsung SMX200, also known as Patrak. So just for you to know, Patrak, the name of your phone is today also, right? But let's start with Shyam Mukund. Welcome, Shyam Mukund. You can unmute yourself and bring today's offering to the altar.
Hare Krishna, everyone. I would like to share one quote from Richard Rohr's book Falling Upward, which brought me a question some weeks ago. And yeah, today I went back to it and thought a little bit more about it and formulated the question. So, at first, the quote is on the topic of unconditional and conditional love, and the balance between them, which was surprising for me to hear. So I will read it and then ask the question. Erich Fromm, in his classic book, The Art of Loving, says that the healthiest people he has known and those who very often grow up in the most natural way are those who, between their two parents and early authority figures, experienced a combination of unconditional love along with very conditional and demanding love. This seems to be true of so many effective and influential people, like Saint Francis, John Muir, Eleanor Roosevelt, and Mother Teresa. And you can add your own. Then he continues, I know this is not the current version of what is psychologically correct, because we all seem to think we need nothing but unconditional love. Any law, correction, rule, or limitation is another word for conditional love. It is interesting to me that very clear passages describing both God's conditional love and also God's unconditional love are found in the same scriptures like Deuteronomy and John's Gospel. The only real biblical promise is that unconditional love will have the last word. So this was what made me think about the value of conditional love, especially in relationship to God. Because recently I'm trying to be more focused on the unconditionality and like being able to receive this acceptance through God, from Krishna, and my question is like, what is the healthy balance between the conditional approach in our spiritual life and like, yeah. As Richard Rohr puts also the synonymous with law and rules. And yeah, simply put, what is the value, how to see the value of conditional love with God?
Okay.
Thank you.
No, thank you. Thank you for the question, and thank you for the nuance that you bring to the discussion. Because again, many times we may think unconditional love means it's the only thing, and conditional love has no place at all in any way, in any form. And by what you shared from Richard Rohr, And of course, someone may say, well, that's not the Bhagavatam, and so we disagree, and so on. But also, we could quote the Bhagavatam in that connection, and he quotes the Bible. And it's important to understand what he means by conditional love in the context of unconditional love. And it's interesting because I also am finishing, or I almost finished writing my fourth book, which may be published still in a few months next year, probably beginning of next year. But in the very first chapter, I have a section called "Is Unconditional Love Also Conditional?" So, and there I mentioned, let me read just two lines. I have it in front of me here. It says, "We must recognize that unconditional love does not mean unconditional acceptance of all actions. Love, by its very nature, is always given, but how it is expressed must be guided by wisdom." In reality, there are countless ways in which unconditional love can and should be expressed with conditions, not to compromise its lifeblood, but to safeguard its integrity. So the point is that God's love is unconditional, right? He cannot not love. We will say that many times. He's made of love, he, she, they. They are love. God is love. God necessarily loves. God cannot not love, let's put it that way. But the way that unconditional love would take place, will be expressed, may take different forms, different conditions. That's one way of speaking about that. Now, one way we can speak, and there are different ways to speak about unconditional, and conditional love, right? Unconditional love, that doesn't mean just one undifferentiated, one size fits all approach, right? Like, it doesn't mean I have unconditional love. I will love Krishna, my mom, the dog, my neighbor in exactly the same way because it's unconditional. No, it could be unconditional, but it will take a particular form depending the condition. But still, it's unconditional. But it's expressing it in a particular way. Like Krishna, let's say, Yashoda's love for Nanda Maharaj is unconditional. Yashoda's love for Krishna is unconditional. Yashoda's love for Radha is unconditional. But it will be expressed differently according to the conditions, according to the particular object of that love. So that's one example. Or also we will say, okay, that's another topic of my book. Krishna loves everyone unconditionally. The sweet absolute unconditionally loves both a fervent devotee and someone who denies God's existence. But God's love will manifest differently in each case. All right, this is what Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, right? 4:11, Yatamam prapadyante tamstataiva bhajamyaham. The idea is, according to how someone worships me, I reciprocate accordingly. So how someone worships means the condition. But it's not diminishing the unconditionality of his love toward everyone. That's kind of the foundation to begin with before the conversation, so to say. And Krishna will reciprocate accordingly. In each case, it takes different forms according to the condition, but at the same time remains unconditional. Even if Krishna is embracing a devotee or cutting the head of Jarasandha or killing Kamsa at the arena, still he's showing unconditional love in all those ways. Externally, it takes different shapes according to the circumstance, according to the need of the circumstance, but that's how it works, right? It still is unconditional. Something also that comes to mind, another way of speaking about this will be, which may be more relatable to some of us, the relation between a father and a son. So let's say a good father, is loving his son unconditionally, but his son becomes, I don't know, a heroin addict, and then he becomes a thief and a criminal, and so on and so forth. So on one level, he starts to become a danger to himself, to his father, to the family, to the neighborhood. So his father will continue, again, it's an example, will continue to love his son unconditionally, but will need to put some conditions around the relationship because even to protect his son from himself, right? To protect the son from the son it himself, right? And to keep some other loving dynamics around. That's another important point. Like, because this is another important point, which is if I love someone, ideally, again, we are talking about the ideal love, unconditional ideal love, that love has to go be loving in every direction. So if I'm a father, let's say, and I'm married to someone, and we have a kid, and we have a few other kids, and one of those kids is like this monster in terms of behavior. It's not that because I love that monster child so much, I spoil him in the name of unconditional love, and he's make going crazy and creating hell for my wife, for my other three kids, for the neighborhood. Do you follow my point? So in the name of unconditional love in one direction, I'm allowing so much harm in so many other directions. So the idea, the ethic of love should be how love remains loving in every possible direction. That's an art unto itself. No wonder Richard Rohr quoted Erich Fromm, who wrote this famous book, The Art of Loving. He makes that very clear in his book. Love is not a something that probably we are already doing, but it's an art that needs to be cultivated. So how to be loving, ideally, unconditionally in every direction, loving in every possible direction, sometimes that requires some conditions. But the conditions are in the service of unconditional love. So in that sense, the conditions are an aspect, an expression of unconditional love. They are not like a limitation to unconditional love. They are nuancing or a qualifying of unconditional love. Again, unconditional love doesn't mean just an homogeneous thing. I love everyone unconditionally, and there is no discernment, no critical thinking, and in the name of that, everything goes. That usually, generally, is not much love at all. Many times, that's an excuse for not to cultivate the actual art of love. So, the actual art of love and of unconditional love includes conditions for the sake of love, for the sake of protection, for the sake of so many loving things, for the object of my love. And for the remaining people around me who hopefully are also the object of my love. And that will take so many different stances and shapes and reactions, which outwardly may seem not so loving, right? While the other way around, sometimes we may be caressing someone and you are trying just to manipulate that person for whatever reason. So externally sounds loving, it's not loving. Some other cases doesn't seem too unconditionally loving, and it is. So that's why at the end of the day, we have to become Saragrahi and see things from their essence. So I don't know if that helps, Shyamakund. I've given a few different kind of examples of how unconditional love and conditional love can work in terms of love and as eternal associates loving each other, God loving devotees and non-devotees, so to say, us relating to people here on planet Earth. I don't know if that helps. You tell me.
Definitely, definitely. I love the comparison with the loving father.
Because I love you, I may put you some limits, or I may behave in a certain strict way, even for the sake of upgrading your potential sometimes, right? Like, I don't know, even if you are a student that you go to a teacher to, I don't know, become a topmost musician. And let's to give an example, and if the teacher is unconditionally dedicated to unlock your potential, the teacher may behave in ways that may seem rude sometimes. Not to justify abuse or stuff like that, but sometimes he or she may put conditions or certain create certain conditions so our fullest potential can come. But behind those conditions, there is an unconditional concern for your highest potential, right? So different ways we can talk about it, but I think it's good to keep that nuance and do not think just not unconditional love means everything and anything, and someone created harm and it's a public danger, and why you are not receiving that person, we are supposed to be unconditionally loving. But unconditional love doesn't take one single shape, right? I mean, and I'm talking with some experience, and by saying experience, I say an experience in making and in doing it wrong in the past. In the terms, I don't know, I remember when we were very young, in the ashram, and I was temple president, and it was with intention, but like, let's receive everyone to the ashram, unconditional love, the mercy of Mahaprabhu, let everyone take advantage, and whomever comes and wants to come to live with us, the doors are open. And in that expression of unconditional love, there was so much mess going on and disturbance and people who came for the wrong reasons with unresolved stuff, and we didn't treat them accordingly to what they needed actually, and we just said, let's come. And that, I mean, again, without any bad intention, but I had a more naive idea of unconditional love without this nuance, and in practice that proved not so loving at the end of the day. Well, it was more of a disturbance than an upgrade of unconditional love. Though the intention, the heart was in the right place, so I trust that that heart in the right place helped us to refine what do we mean by that. And yeah, sometimes we may need to say no in the context of unconditional love. No? Like Srila Siddhar Maharaj will say, it all begins with a yes. At the end of the day, unconditional love is the foundation and the highest truth. Srila Siddhar Maharaj will say, all these Vedic mantras begin with Om, and Om means yes. So it begins with this yes of welcoming, of accepting, of trying to see everyone in the most positive possible way, seeing everyone according to the brightest potential, be as generous as we can. But after we have said that yes, some no's may be needed to be invoked. But we have to start with a yes, right? Not with a no. But after one yes, a few no's may come, a few conditions in that sense. A few conditions in the context of the unconditional yes that began it all, right? So, yeah, it will take endless shapes according to each time, place, and circumstance and condition. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well, there are two more raised hands so far. So if there may be more later, let's see. But meanwhile, we can go for a few minutes to our breakout rooms in Zoom, so we can sit together in small circles, smaller circles, and discuss, churn together how do we experience this combination of unconditional love, including conditional love, how we can embrace that principle if you feel like it in a healthy way. Again, not going to the extreme of sheer unconditionality that ends up being damaging, or sheer conditionality at the same time. So Bhakti Rasa will invite us there for a few minutes, and we'll see you soon back. Welcome. Welcome you all back. Hoping you had a constructive, productive, fruitful churning on this important topic of conditional and unconditional love. Also, I've just now saw that you were sharing some comments while I was saying something, trying to say something, and that I didn't read. So sorry for that. Jugal Kishore was mentioning the only true condition is the intention of wanting what is best for the beloved, with respect to their own capacity. So that's a very important consideration. Adhikar, right? So Sve Adhikari Janishta Saguna Parikirtita Bhagavatam says, to establish our capacity, this true beauty, to receive love, to give love to whatever we need at any given moment. Jivan Prabhu referred to the prodigal son from the Bible. And Nityananda Das drew a parallel to Oriental philosophy, referring to the yin yang, loving the expression of the yin principle. And conditions within which it flows will be the expression of the yang principle, the masculine side. So if you remove the yang, the yin will be fully manifest in all its beauty. So yeah, it's all about the integration of polarities, basically, right? Yin yang. We can talk about Radha and Krishna, and in one sense, you can read the union of Radha and Krishna as esoteric as it sounds and as Leela-like as it is. It can be also read in a symbolic way in terms of integration of polarities, the yin and the yang. Like the example I gave, I mean, I gave an example of the father and son. I didn't repeat the example that Richard Rohr mentioned originally that Shyam Kunda read. I gave maybe a little bit more of an extreme example of the criminal son, but you don't need to be a criminal son to receive conditions to be a healthy human being, of course, right? So the mother is generally expected to show that side of the equation, which is unconditional love, and the father is expected to to put limits and to put boundaries, and the two working together as a team will create that healthy combination. And any lack of the two of them creates a deficiency, or any just extreme of one or the other. And I personally have seen also nowadays, many people nowadays refer to many, how to say, kids from this generation as the crystal generation, in terms of many times in the name of unconditional love, there are not that enough conditions put. And kids are starving for someone telling, giving them some parameter, because if it's all unconditional love, you basically have no clue what to do with your life. It's chaotic. It's too much. So you need some certainty, some perimeter, and that's the role, whether of the father of someone, for us to have that balance between chaos and order, yin and yang, unconditional love, and conditional love expressed in the context of unconditional love. Again, it's not unconditional love by itself, it's one extreme. Conditional love by itself, it's another extreme. So we need a proper integration of both. But at the end of the day, this conditionality, it's in the service of the foundation of unconditional love. But again, and there are many stories in our tradition that mention that, how even, again, not to misuse or abuse these ideas, but like chastisement could be a form of care and love from the father to the kid, or the teacher to the disciple. Srila Siddhartha Maharaj once said that, "Oh, Gurudev chastised me. Oh, that shows how he cares for me. He dares to chastise me. He shows his interest in me." Again, not to justify violence or abuse, but there is a place for certain loving. Again, as long as there is a backdrop of love, unconditional love, chastising, maybe there are rules, maybe there are structure, maybe there. Because if not, again, we may become too crystal-like, too fragile, too much lacking in resilience. So sometimes, as I gave the example of the teacher, to the student, the teacher will put obstacles and challenges, not for the sake of them, not for the sake of making the life of the student miserable, but for creating, invoking strength in overcoming those challenges. At the end, and the result of that will be you will become a more resilient human being. So anyhow, I just became inspired by these comments. I wanted to honor them since I couldn't read all of them. And also, I'd like to ask you, as we have been doing this last few weeks, who would like to share any further insights that came during the private room sharing, breakthrough room in Zoom regarding this topic? If any of you will feel like it, you can raise your digital hand. I'm seeing Rasangi raising her hand. I mean, your digital hand is raised, just in case. That's what I'm saying.
I was raised for question
Oh, okay,
after.
okay. Okay, well, yeah, we'll put you in the queue. There are a few others also. But first of all, any of you would like to share anything else that came that is shareable, publicly shareable, some jewel that you've discovered in the sharing, small sharing? Okay. You found too much of a confidential jewels to be shared publicly. I totally honor that. It's totally fine. Let's continue with the next question. I see that you continue sharing some comments, and it's fine, but I do not want to overgo too much there, because if not, we create like a parallel universe, and it may be a little bit too difficult to follow track of everything. So let's go to the next raised hand from Hari Vyasadev. You can mute yourself, then we go to Patrak, then we go to Rasangi.
Thank you, Maharaj. Pranam to you and to everybody present. I have a question which might be a bit touchy. And for me, and I think for many others, it's kind of an elephant in the room. And we had this small, brief conversation on WhatsApp. And I already asked the question, but you propose we should discuss it here. So, well, I think the question is roughly what would you, as a person, of a Western background, do with all the implications that arise from following or being part of a tradition which manifested itself in India, in a foreign land to your country of origin, for example. I think so many times we hear Srila Prabhupada saying how Krishna consciousness does not belong to any nationality or country. It's not Indian, it's not American, it's not German or whatever. But at the same time, I think we can't ignore that embracing that mythical landscape of an Indian religion, so to say, doesn't bring certain psychological implications. So, of course, there is a cultural aspect as well, being maybe the language, the music, the clothing. So I was just wondering, what are your thoughts on India and Krishna consciousness?
Well, thank you for that. That's and yeah, that's one of the many perennial questions. It's never a settled issue, right? It's not something that okay, we there comes the answer and topic close, final word. It's an ongoing conversation because there is always something to adjust, and it won't be the same answer to for every person, right? Every person will feel differently about this. But that's definitely a necessary question to discern between details and principles, essentials and non-essentials, culture here, culture in the Leela, right? Because there is some type of culture in the Leela, right? Our idea of eternity is not acultural, so to say. Like there is just like sheer Brahman experience, so to say. So there are no people and clothes and people talking and dancing and animals and land. No, it's just sheer light. So the cultural problem, you're safe from the cultural problem, but you lose a few other things on the way, we will say. At the same time, if we talk about the Leela and about eternity, we are talking about a very flexible landscape, right? Not to the point that it accommodates anything and everything to the point of absolute eternal rasa abhas, right? That nothing makes sense and everything gets in the way of a proper experience. But it's also flexible enough to accommodate diversity and accommodate some possibilities that may not have been revealed so far in scripture, so to say. I wrote an article, I think it was last year, maybe you read that one, Hariviasa, I don't remember. In a magazine that was published by Krishna Chandra Prabhu from Anandadham, a magazine they published, I think, twice a year called Amrit. And it was an article on culture. It's on my website also. And I started with Srila Prabhupada once. He loved to play harmonium, right? And many devotees nowadays play harmonium in kirtan, which, by the way, is not native from India. No, it's not a native instrument from India at all. So it's come from Europe. It has been adjusted to be played on the floor since Indians do everything sitting on the floor, peeling potatoes, going to the bathroom, playing harmonium. So it looks Indian, but it's not Indian. But I know many devotees nowadays that if they say, let's do kirtan, and they will say, where's the harmonium? There's no harmonium. Many will freeze not knowing what to do because harmonium became so much a part of kirtan that, no? An example, and Prabhupada, he loved to play harmonium. And once someone asked him, Prabhupada, is there, because from the descriptions we received so far from the scripture, from Shastra about the Leela and even some instruments that are being played, harmonium is not mentioned, right? But Prabhupada used to love playing harmonium. So someone asked him, so, Prabhupada, is there harmonium in the spiritual world? No? And do they play harmonium in the spiritual world? And Prabhupada says something like, yeah, a little, they play. Yeah, they play. Like implying, so far nobody has said that, but I like to play harmonium so much. So I hope there is a place for me playing harmonium over there, right? So I thought I think that answer is not only charming, but it's very accurate. It makes a very deep theological point, which is about, again, the flexibility of transcendence to accommodate newness, as long as it's not interrupting the mood and the flow of the Leela. So it's not that, okay, so far we have been playing Veena and whatever instrument here in Golok, and now this guy comes with harmonium and he's disrupting the whole mood. And no. As long as that's not the case, there's place for welcoming new elements. I mean, each one of us, and that's a different topic, but it's connected. In any community, every time you have a new member in a community, that new member is creating a new community. I mean, the community becomes new by the addition of that new member. It's never the same. Unless that new member is not allowed to feel, think, speak, to which you will argue what type of community is that. But if it's a real community, any new participation there, any new member, is transforming the community with its own individual existence. So we can ex extend that to the ultimate community, right? To transcendence, and to the fact that each one of us are in prospect attempting to enter there. I'm not of the idea that if we were there and we fell from there, that's another conversation. So when a newcomer arrives to Golok Vrindavan, though subjectively it will feel like I've been here forever, that person is adding a new flavor to the community. So the realm, the abode, is accommodating that recently arrived diversity, so to say. Again, in certain parameters, certain conditions, going back to unconditional, unconditional. So there is place for certain diversity. There is place for that. I mean, again, the very name Vaikuntha, right? I speak about this in my third book. Vaikuntha means without limits. Again, that doesn't mean anything and everything can happen, and someone enters and kills Krishna and burns the whole Vrindavan. We are not going to those extremes of absurdity. But at the same time, within certain parameters, it is limitless, right? Like if I tell you, we are talking about the realm of play, the realm of Leela, right? The spiritual world, realm of play. Let's take a play here, and I sit with you and say, let's play chess. Of course, that's a wrong example because I don't know how to play chess, but let's suppose I know how to play chess. There are rules for how to play chess, right? It's not that just let's be free and flow and move your pieces however you like. That's not to play chess. If I try to move my pieces all together and your pieces along with mine, you are saying, what are you doing? This is not play. So there are some conditions, and in those conditions, but the point is, in the context of those conditions that look like limitations, there are unlimited possibilities. There's no limit, even though we are speaking about a certain perimeter. A certain limit facilitates limitless expression. So in the same way, there are certain perimeter in the Leela, which is not that you can do anything and everything, but within that certain perimeter of sensibility to rasa, let's put it that way, there are endless prospect. So for me, in that sense, there is play for someone playing harmonium. There is play for someone, I don't know, offering pizza to Krishna. Why not? Or things like that. No, like I wouldn't say that's a total disruption to the flow of Leela, right? Again, as long as it comes from a genuine place. So I'm talking a little bit how it looks over there, so to say, how that realm can accommodate all that. So with that in mind, I will say we have to be accommodating enough here so we are not projecting our practice to an eternity that is rigid in that way. So because the whole thing is you do not arrive suddenly to Golok Vrindavan and then you receive a map to figure it out. How to behave here, what to do, and what not to do. You start to live in such a way here and now that there is a smooth transition as a sadhaka into your eternal existence to the point that you don't even realize when that happened. You suddenly are there. And for that, you need to unfold your practice here in a coherent way that makes sense and that is a lifestyle that is sustainable in eternity, as I like to say. We have to craft a lifestyle here and now that somehow is sustainable in eternity. You follow? So in one sense, there are things that we may be doing that are possible there in eternity. And there are some other things that we know won't be happening there. And even if I'm doing them, I know that at one point I may need to release them. I don't know. Someone say, well, I'm addicted to my whatever, to my TikTok account. Well, there's not TikTok in Golok Vrindavan. So hopefully you work on that because there's another type of technology going on there, way more sophisticated. It's called Prem, the technology of divine love. That's another form of communication. And if you need messengers, you don't need messenger, you will have messengers, cuckoos and birds and all sorts of animals, very natural and organic. So, but something we should be adjusting, or even if we are using them, we know at some point that's not required. So, all that to say, Haribia Sadev, I agree with you. I mean, I think that there are things that can be adjusted. At the same time, there will be always more orthodox practitioners. There will be always more heterodox practitioners. And heterodoxy, I wouldn't say, is the opposite of orthodoxy. The opposite of orthodox is heresy. But the orthodox, many times, will think the heterodox are heretics. And that tension, hopefully a creative one, will always be there. When someone is like, no, like, I don't know, to be honest, like in Christianity, you may say, okay, Christianity has adapted a lot to the West to the point that we think it's a Western religion. Well, actually, it's coming from the East. It's as Eastern as is our tradition in one sense. But it has adapted in so many ways that you tend to think it more as a religion from your country, native. At the same time, of course, we say Christianity, but there are 20,000 denominations of it. And some of them will be more like, let's keep the mass in Latin. And for some others, it's like, no, that's too old school. Let's adjust for the contemporary audience. And for others, no, but the Latin has its own mysticism and its own. And I'm not here someone saying this or the other, black or white. It's like, whatever works better for each one, let's have the menu open. As long as we are not deviating from the essence of the tradition, for me, that's a detail, to be honest. If you tell me, Maharaj, shall we sing kirtan in English or in Sanskrit or in Bengali? And I will say whatever works better for you. I mean, whatever helps you convey your heart and your feeling in the best way. For some, it will be their local language. And by language, I'm saying also their local culture in terms of food or in terms of dress, extending the idea of language. And for others, they may like to sing in Sanskrit and they may know Sanskrit and they may love Indian music. And for some, it may be a little bit of both. As I always said, I have the fortune in my racing, Gaudiya Vaishnava racing in Argentina, we had the whole songbook translated into Spanish. And we sang almost all the songs in Spanish as well as in their original language. So we will choose. You choose. You chose. Okay. Spanish today, Sanskrit tomorrow. And many times, of course, if you don't know the Sanskrit or the Bengali, in general, probably will help to sing your local language to have a clue of what you are talking about. And again, for me, it's a detail. It's not like you are betraying the heart of Mahaprabhu by not singing in Bengali and by daring to sing in English or German or whatever, right? I mean, I can tell you many beautiful experiences I had singing in Spanish. It's not like Prabhupada says Spanish is the language to speak with God. So I know you guys who speak in English and German, you figured that out, but I sing in Spanish. I'm legal. Language to speak with God. Of course, we shouldn't make of that example something reductionistic. Okay, only Sanskrit, Bengali, and Spanish. Nothing else than that. That's not the point, of course. So the same with other things, no, like the clothing or this or that. But at the same time, I will say there is a space in transcendence for accommodating some diversity. As you say, Vaikuntha means without limits. Braj, the word braj means to move. It's a verb. Krishna says, Sarva dharmam paritya ajam mamekam sharanam braj. Braj means come to me, implies movement. So it's a moving land, it's a dynamic land. So it can accommodate things. Of course, there is a certain setting that we don't want to like transform Krishna into something absolutely different from the descriptions we hear, but there is place for flexibility. Again, at the end of the day, we can speak about what's going on in the spiritual world, we can read about it, but the rest is go in there and have your own experience. Still, we are somehow projecting our ideas about it on some degree or another, probably. So at the end of the day, it's having a deep personal experience and realizing the all-accommodating power of that land. Like I remember talking to Krishna Chandra Prabhu a few years ago, and he lives, of course, there in the Alps in Switzerland. So he loves snow, right? So he was like, we were talking about these depictions of in Govinda Lilamrita or Krishna Bhavanamrita about There is a six seasonal forest in Braj that Radha and Krishna go and visit during their Madhyan Lila, the midday pastimes. And there's like winter and summer, but there's not literally like Alp-like snow. And he was right, like pushing for it. Like, I want that. No, I don't think there cannot be that. He will not like being whimsical and I'm imposing my selfish taste onto transcendence, but that can be anudipana for some. Okay, it's culture. You were born in that country and snow triggers you in a good way. But why that cannot become part of bhakti? That can be. It can be part of bhakti. And that's the power of bhakti. Now, bhakti is not conditional in the sense of, okay, this is who we are. You totally adapt to us and that's it. There is a part of us that has to adapt also. That's it. That's the balance for me. It's not like, hey guys, I'm born in this country with this culture, so I want the whole Krishna Lila to adjust to my Argentinian raising. So because I have this culture, I'm culturally conditioned like to that. So the whole transcendence have to adapt to that. That's too much. We'd also have to adjust, and we also have to recognize toxic elements from any culture also. It's not that every cultural inheritance we have is absolutely divine and sustainable in eternity. So there may be things that we may need to let go, not all, but some. But at the same time, that land is willing to adjust to some of our personal preferences that can be transformed into an offering and made their way into transcendence. Like again, going back to Prabhupada, yeah, some harmonium is there. I mean, till Prabhupada say that, there was no harmonium in Golok Vrindavan, I will say. But at that moment, okay. There is some harmonium shop in Golok Vrindavan and someone making it so Prabhupada can have some interesting time there and so many others. Why not? There is place for new creation, for new unfolding. The creative unfolding of the Swarup Shakti is very, again, it's very creative. We cannot underestimate the creativity of Purnamasi, Yogamaya, and all the orchestration going on in the Lila. So that's what I will say, right? Each one have to find their point, and we have to be also honoring of that because it's even outside, as I say, even outside of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, even speaking about Christianity or other traditions, of no tradition at all, just people. Some people will say, I like more Chinese food, I like more African drumming music, and I like more this type of dressing. And they're all from the same country, and we all live together in the same neighborhood, and we are not killing each other because of those differences. So why not the same thing can happen in a particular spiritual community? Not necessarily all of them will be dressing in the same way, having the same eating tastes, having the same musical flavors, but still unity and diversity, be it a bit, with the knowing that realm is all accommodating, but also we should be all accommodated in response. It's a mutual co-creation. So those will be my thoughts. Again, I'm not giving you any particular definitive formula, and this is the way and the only way, because that in itself is a problem we want to avoid, right? So, what do you think, Hari Vyasadeva? Share some of those ruminations.
Thank you, Maharaj. Yeah, I think, like you said in the beginning, it's a very kind of a perennial topic. It's open to endless discussion and rumination. But I like that you brought up how Christianity itself is now it feels Western, but it started somewhere else. It started in the East, and of appreciate your openness or also bringing up Leela as play again, making us conscious of the meaning of the word and how that can encompass so much, actually unlimited opportunities to serve.
Yeah. And of course, that say Hari Vyasadeva in general, and I don't want to speak for a group or an individual, but in general, yeah, I do consider that still there is some work to be done in terms of adjusting, not so much even the presentation of the message for a contemporary Western audience, if we are Western, but also for us to process the practice being born in a Western culture. Still, there is work to do, but again, it's a matter of time as well. We may say, okay, Christianity, at least some groups of it seem more settling to a Western way of presenting itself. but it has taken a few thousand years. And Gaudiya Vaishnavism, in terms of its interaction with the West, is relatively a baby. So it takes some time. No, it takes some time. Not to say that we just sit and wait for the miracle to happen. Each one of us have to do our part of it. So I agree that there is something to be said about that, but also there is something to be said about everything else. So we don't want to be extremely, again, right wing, left wing, whatever, liberal, conservative, yin yang, all the polarities that we've been talking about, and trying to find a middle point, but also understanding that the middle point is different for everyone. How my middle point looks will look very different to how your middle point looks and everyone else's middle point looks. And even for me, my middle point will shift throughout my life so many times. So it's an ongoing revision of balance, right? Thank you. Okay, another hot, touchy topic. So we'll go to breakout rooms to set you all on fire in the good sense of the term. Hopefully, you can share some important insights with each other, be generous with each other, and those who cannot join, spend some minutes of personal introspection about this important theme, and we see you back in a few minutes for a few remaining questions. Okay, there you are back. Welcome. So, with the hope that you have some enriching exchange before going to the next question, I'd like to invite whomever feels inspired to share something publicly shareable of some of the little giant jewels you got from your intimate conversation in the breakout breakthrough. Hopefully, rooms. So, Will, welcome. You can unmute yourself and share your gift with us.
Oh, I'd just like to express appreciation for Cassandra, who's been a very good companion for me. Unfortunately, our conversation just ended at quite an interesting point for me. I'd just like to make a quick point. I have to leave very soon, but I think one thing certainly I think needs to be stressed or brought to mind is that concessions to like foreign dress or habits can, the advantage can be that it holds people together. It which is actually an advantage if you're in some way drawn together because you're wearing an unusual dress or eating unusual food and these types of things. The advantage is it kind of obliges you in a way, or you get attracted to a certain community, and that's actually, I think, helpful in a society to be. You know, to be drawn together, or to in some way forced to live together, or to that, I find it's a very, it's strengthening, because society was always trying to undermine you. So if you have a certain clothing or a little tilak on your forehead or something like that, actually, although you feel awkward, that awkwardness is a very good thing, because it actually is it protects you against the society, which will otherwise gladly tear you and your friends apart. That's my idea. I don't know if that's true or not. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing. No, I'm not here to tell what's true, what's not, what's correct or not. We are inviting everyone to share their opinions. Thank you so much, Will. Badra?
Haribol Maharaj and everyone. Yeah, this is a very fascinating subject that I often think about. We have unique forest here in New Zealand, as you probably know. We've got unique trees and ferns, and I live right on the edge of it. And sometimes I go into the forest with my japa beads and think about Krishna and his leelas in the kunjas of Vrindavan, and think it just seems so natural that they be carried out in this beautiful New Zealand forest setting that's typical to this country. And then I sort of remember how I was just listening the other day to my god sister Jadurani Dasi, also known as Shamarani Dasi, on Namrasa's podcast. She was telling how when she was Prabhupada was guiding her with her painting, she did something that sort of resembled some Western painter or something Western in the painting, And Prabhupada said, no, not like that. And it should be the traditional Indian style. I'm maybe not saying exactly what Shamarani said, but this is the understanding I got from her words, that Prabhupada had kind of steered her away from bringing in the Western influence, even in a little detail in her paintings. And when I heard that, I thought sometimes I disagree with Prabhupada, not in a deep way, not in a really major way, but little details here and there, because I thought of my own situation of seeing Krishna and Radha and all the gopis and gopas carrying out their pastimes here in the beautiful forests of New Zealand. And I can't see how that's wrong. I can't see how that's kind of off track. And but just marrying it with, and I've got another example also from my Shiksha guru, what he said, but I won't go into that right now. But it was along the line of what Srila Prabhupada said. And so yeah, just marrying these things together, I'm still a little question around it. I'm not asking you to clarify now, but I'm just saying that, yeah.
There are some nice volcanoes over there in New Zealand. Maybe we have some volcanoes in the Lila. They may erupt at times whenever it's necessary, especially maybe in times of separation. Thank you. Thank you, Padre. And even I was thinking, and I don't want to sound like I'm like trying to contradict Prabhupada or something, but when he will say the Indian style, but also what's the Indian style? There are so many Indian style of painting, and I've seen so many paintings of Krishna, very different from each other, different schools, and they're all beautiful. They're all Indian, but they are very different from each other also, right? So, I mean, I can imagine from which place he may try to preserve something at that time, trying to be careful about let not these kids make who knows what in a few years, because that's the same person who say there's a little harmonium over there, right? So he himself made the point that there is place for unfolding and inclusion. So I can imagine from which place he may have been a little bit more cautious at that time in those beginning times. But anyhow, thank you. Thank you, Bhadra. Jugal Kishore Das. With raised hand.
I'll keep it very short. We return to the question of unconditional love, and we're just ending in talking about how the importance of having unconditional self-love is as a prerequisite to loving others, and how important humility is in that quality of self-love, something like that.
Thank you, brothers. Thank you to all of you for sharing some of the jewels you found in the breakout rooms, and we'll continue. We have two more raised hands, original raised hands regarding topics or questions. First, Patrak in Austria, I assume, and then Rasangi, the birthday girl. Patrak, welcome.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, Hare Krishna everybody. I got a question about Shraddha Devi, and maybe it's a very easy question to answer. I don't know. I'm curious what you will say. Maybe it's a no and a yes or no answer even.
There is some
So here
kirtan
it
going
goes.
on in the back. Is possible, Patrick?
It is possible, yes. Can you still hear
Try
me?
to talk close to the computer so we can hear. And
Okay,
it's nice to have the kirtan in the background as well.
so here goes the question. Can Shraddha Devi manifest in the heart of the devotee who studies Shastra without associating and learning personally from a guru? Is it possible when a guru is not available and only the books of other teachers and acharyas are available?
Thank you for the question and greetings to Mayapur Sangha. I can hear she's the one singing the kirtan. I have musicians at ear, so I can get that one. So thank you for the question on Shraddha. And in brief, the answer, because it's like a yes or no answer, my answer to begin with will be yes. I'm reminded of a very interesting article that you may search. It's an interesting one, written by Srila Bhakti Pragyan Kesava Maharaj, called Shastriya Sadhu Sangha. Right? Sometimes we have Shastriya Shraddha, right? We hear about Shastriya Shraddha, that our faith should be based on the revelation, but that the importance of hearing Shastra and revelation from the lips of Vaishnav, Sadhu Sangha, Guru, etc. And in this article, Bhakti Pragyan Kesava Maharaj, of course, that's kind of the general rule. We are not here trying to cancel that. But he brings the point of, well, what if in some particular given circumstance, a person doesn't have the access to, well, he wrote at the time that there was no social media and internet, and you were be listening online to your guru, so to say. But still, the hypothetical question remains, which is, if you cannot have sadhu sangha, because still in person sadhu sangha is a different thing than even what we are having now, without wanting to underestimate what we are having now, which I totally love. Please don't take that away from me. But it's not enough for me. That's why I travel around the world to meet you in 3D, because if not, I just keep here. It's comfortable, but that's not the same. So when we do not have that chance for in-person sadhu sangha, how to receive sadhu sangha? Now, since sadhu sangha is so important, and Srila Kesava Maharaj will say, well, Shastriya sadhu sangha. No? Shastra can be a form of sadhu sangha in those cases, because through Shastra also we have so many great personalities speaking, no? So many sadhus speaking. Of course, at the same time, we have this triune, you say in English, triune, triple definition of guru, shastra, and sadhu. So clearly each one is in a different place. If not, you will just say sadhu and it encompasses all of them, or you will just say shastra and encompasses all of them. So there is a unique role to this tree. But in certain cases, shastra can, like, it may be more like apadharma, like emergency case. Shastra could serve as sadhu sangha, especially if we have the sincerity to approach it. Because again, at the end of the day, Shraddha Devi, Shraddha, no? Shraddha Devi is a Devi, is a goddess of faith, divine faith, moves independently like Bhakti does, Jadrichaya. So it's not like, okay, if there is not in person sadhu in front of you, you have no access to Shraddha at all. At the end of the day, what counts a lot is our genuine longing and sincerity for a drop of that, so to say. And if that longing is there, it can attract that, like the famous Chatak bird, right? The Chatak bird is having access to different sources of water, but it's very determined. I only want just a drop from what comes from above, from descending grace. And by that determination and longing, the Chatak bird is melting the hearts of the storm gods, and eventually a torrential downpour comes. Not only one drop for the Chatak bird, but the whole village becomes flooded with rain in the good sense. So in the same way, someone may not be having in-person sadhu sangha while longing for it, and that person's sincerity will attract sadhu sangha to manifest through the pages of Shastra, and eventually through some. And not only pages of Shastra, eventually, of course, if you are very advanced or very sincere, you may be able to draw to obtain the experience of sadhu sangha everywhere and anywhere, right? In the beginning, it's more hyper localized. Again, go to your guru, listen what to do, what not to do, A, B, C, D. Eventually, it expands beyond the guru. There are other gurus, there are other sadhus in your tradition, in other traditions. There is sadhu sangha in Shastra, there is sadhu sangha in every atom, in the neighbor, in everywhere. And then the Bhagavatam throws you to these 24 gurus, which none of them are human, basically. And you can nourish your Shraddha through all of them. But again, it depends where we are. But I will say that in general, yes, we can get our Shraddha nourished by Shastra. Because at the end, Shraddha, as it's described in Chaitanya Charitamrita, and I'm trying to recall the Bengali, and it's not coming. Sarva karma krita hai, vishva shraddha sabde vishva sudhrida nishchay, Krishna Bhakti Kaile Sarva Karma Kritta Hai. So Shraddha means the trust that by serving Krishna, basically you're watering the root of the plant and everything is being fulfilled by by dedicating yourself to the center. So that's Shraddha. So Shraddha can be nourished, Shraddha can be manifest in whatever ways we gain inspiration for that dedication to the center. And that can come from scripture, that can come from Shastra. And on the contrary, we can be in front of the, just to bring some contrast, we may be sitting in front of the, let's put it that way, topmost Mahabhagavat guru on planet Earth. Like if someone could measure that, that's another way, another conversation, but let's make it hypothetical. You are just sitting in front, in person, living with, listening every day from the topmost Rasik Acharya, Mahabhagavat, pure devotee guru on the whole planetary system. And you may not be getting much because your heart is not in the right place. So physical proximity to the guru doesn't warrant everything, no? Like Srila Maharaj will give the example. It's like a guru may be there, and in his body there may be many of these like parasites that are like taking the guru's blood, so to say, feeding on the guru, so to say. They are very close physically, very intimately associated with the guru in physical terms, but they are sucking the guru's blood. So he gave the point, some disciples may also be like that. Externally, they may be appearing in every picture, very physically close, but internally there may be an abyss. And by contrast, some other great personalities may not have the possibility of in-person association with the sadhu, but by their sincerity, they will gain all the revelations required. And these are two extremes, of course. There are, most of the examples are laying somewhere in between that. And of course, even if we cannot get that association, we are sincere and will be longing for that. Sometimes I like to think about the example of the gopis, right? They want to be with Krishna. They want to be with him, but in separation from him, they cannot find Krishna, but paradoxically, they find Krishna everywhere. Krishna starts to manifest everywhere, but still they long for that one Krishna and the personal association with him. And once it came to me that type of, I mean, not it may sound a little bit too too wild, but somehow that idea I could resound with that, because in my personal situation, having somehow have to have some distance by choice or force of circumstance from some of my previous gurus, I felt something like that at times. Like, okay, I'm longing and always open to have that type of connection with great personalities. But if at times that becomes unavailable in certain form, Guru Tattva manifests all over. You know? Like the gopis looking for Krishna, not finding Krishna per se, but finding Krishna everywhere. I remember my time at one point, okay, my guru took distance from me. You know the story, no need for details. And in that situation, I still longed for that connection, not necessarily with one particular person, but with the principle. And that principle erupted from everywhere. But at the same time, I'm not taking that as an excuse not to look for that personalized connection and source. So I think that's how it works. And I don't want to sound like I'm putting myself as an example, but just how it happened in my life by grace. So going back to the initial yes to your question, yes, it's possible that Shraddha Devi can manifest in certain cases without the ongoing living presence and guidance of the guru. But again, with this, I'm not saying we replace parampara, let's go Ritvik. I'm not saying anything like that. But I'm just saying time, place, and circumstance. And at the end of the day, Srila Samaras will say sincerity is invincible. So even if the normal situation through which you usually got Shraddha or got this are not in place for reasons beyond your control, if there is deep honesty and sincerity, the impossible can happen, the unthinkable can become plausible. So there may be still exceptions to the rule, but still it's important to be open to that whenever that's genuine. And at the same time, of course, emphasize the normal course of events for the majority, which in a genuine way also, not like a rigid thing. You need to go to this person and only this in a very like formulaic transactional way, but just as a natural exchange of hearts, basically, because that's basically Shraddha. Shraddha is faith, and faith is not a dogma or an imposed belief. It's an experience. So when you have an exchange of heart with someone, you are having an experience. And that experience, on the basis of that experience, you can develop your Shraddha. If you meet a transformed soul, the proximity to that person, even if you are open to that, gives you an experience. You may not be having the experience of that person, but you're having the experience of being close to that person's experience. And that in itself is enough of an experience for us. And based on that experience, we develop Shraddha, trust based on experience. But again, if that's not available for whatever reason, Shastra can give that experience. Because remember, we talked about that in our initial Bhagavatam classes, which now are in pause for some time. And Shastra is not a dead book, right? Shastra is a living conversation. So we are talking with someone. There is someone on the other side of the page. It's not, okay, now there is no sadhu, no living actual person. I'm just with a dusty old book that is not alive. That's not Shastra. It's living sound. It's full of vibrancy and aliveness. So from that place, the personalities and the matches and the content of Shraddha is ever evolving, ever fresh, ever new. Shraddha can be conveyed through that. If we, again, if we do our part, allowing ourselves to be opened by Shastra, we say many times. It's not just we open the book has to open us. And the book is not only a book. So all that to say yes, Patrak. But I'm a very wordy person, as you can see. I could have just said yes and next question, but I felt we needed to expand a little bit. I hope it's clear. That helps. You tell me.
Yeah, that's great, and thank you for spending the time. And just a little follow-up question: are Shraddha Devi and Bhakti Devi friends? Are they interested in what the other one is doing, or don't they really mind what the other
Yeah,
one is doing?
they hang out together quite often, I will say. Yeah. Yeah. They like each other a lot. Not to say they are even the same person. Yeah. Yeah, of course. Yeah, at the end of the day, all this Devi's converge in the figure of Sri Radha. Right? Sri Radha is the goddess of love, the goddess of bhakti, the goddess of faith, the goddess, you can call her Bhakti Devi, Shraddha Devi, Premi Devi, you name it. But she is Devi. No, Devi Krishnamayi Prokta, and so on. So she's Devi. All Devis are expressions of the Devi, at least from our Gaudiya perspective. So yeah. And she's Karuneshwari, right? She's Kripa Mayi. She's an ocean of mercy. She's supremely, supremely gracious. So that's how faith also can come to our heart. It's a gift. Okay, thank you. Let's go a few more minutes. Let's make a breakout room since we don't have that many questions than usual. A few minutes in breakout room, and then we'll return for the last sharing from Rasangi. Okay, welcome you all back. Hoping you had some nourishing time enlightening one another. Like the Bhagavad Gita said, Bodhayanta Parasparam, shedding light unto one another, Tushyanti Charamanti Cha, nourishing one another, relishing. Katayanta Shtamanityam, perpetually speaking about Hari. Before I forget, I'm sharing here in the chat the article I was referring to by Srila Bhakti Prayankesh Maharaj, if some of you would like to read it. And before we go to Rasangi's question, anyone that would like to share any insight, any highlight, anything worthy of sharing publicly that came from your breakthrough rooms in private, you can raise your digital hand if there is anything you feel called, inspired to bring to the table. There is not. It's totally fine. Thank you so much for your sincerity. And we invite Rasangi to raise, I mean, not to raise her hand, she already did that, to unmute herself. Welcome. And one
Thank
more
you.
time, happy birthday.
Thank you. I feel filled up and so loved. The sangha is amazing. I feel it's genuine love, and thank you so much. So my question, it seems to be in the air today. And then I have a second question if there's time. But the first one is like, we hear this subject all the time, this being said, don't water down the philosophy. Like, you know what I mean? And there's a kind of a looming
I'm
thing.
not hearing that all the time.
Oh, I have heard it for years. I
Okay,
have
that's
heard.
another thing that say we are all. Don't put me in
Oh,
that
yeah.
bad, please. Make it
But
radically personal.
that what don't water down the philosophy. And I'm thinking to myself, what does that mean even? Is there really a way to water down our philosophy, or is that just resistance to evolution and change? But is there something that we don't want to water down, that we really want to preserve and not bend on?
So that was a question. Wow. Okay. Yeah, maybe that's a great question for you to ask whomever tells you don't water down the philosophy. You can ask, are you asking what do you mean by that? And maybe the person doesn't even know what to say. But I agree with your point you mentioned. I mean, without throwing a universal diagnosis here. But many times, at least many times, when someone may hear that, it's not so much about watering down, which can happen. I'm not saying it cannot happen, but it's about the attempt to preserve something as it is without understanding that the only way to preserve anything is to allow growth to happen. It's like the moment you freeze something in an attempt to preserve it, you have prevented it from growing. And growing many times implies decay and collapse sometimes also. It's part of the cycles of nature, right? You see that for something new to grow, something needs to die and collapse and be reborn again in a new shape. So sometimes, again, I'm not saying there is bad intention. There may be just too much of a fearful orientation around what it means to preserve. And we end up making everything like a museum relic rather than a very dynamic, ever-evolving reality, especially talking about something like this, right? Something like a living current, parampara, no? La parampara should be like a live wire, right? Like you get in touch and you become electrified without dying, right? But you have to be electrified, ideally. If you enter into genuine contact with a living member of a living lineage, you will feel that aliveness coming to you. You will feel I'm being plugged to the live wire. And that's how you preserve the lineage. You know, it's not just let's keep the books and let's copy paste and repeat what the ancient teachers say without anything else being added to that, because that means watering down. Not necessarily, that could mean further ornamentation in the service of the ancient revelation. Again, there can be a watering down. I'm not saying there cannot be. There are deviations, potential deviations. There can be apasampradayic conceptions. That's there. But not necessarily an evolutionary embrace of a tradition is a watering down. On the contrary. But that will be the perennial tension between, again, someone who may be more orthodox and maybe more like, we have to copy paste what was said by whomever. Someone will say Srila Prabhupada, someone will say Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta, someone will say Ramanujacharya, someone will say Rupa Goswami. You choose, you name it. And we cannot say anything else, anything more than them. Ideally say less, but actually the real invitation is say more. Srila Prabhupada himself said that. He said the duty of every member of the parampara is to write something that contributes, enhances, and beautifies the previous writings of the Acharyas. If one writes at all, he will say, it's not that he's forcing everyone to write, but he will say, if you write at all, it doesn't make any sense to write something that you just repeat the same thing that the other person already said. For that, you have that book already. So you have to bring something new. And if you cannot bring something new, then don't write. It's okay. But learn something new. Understand that it's all about newness. That's why I wrote that third book, right? To bring that point, like, There's so much newness happening. Everything is ever new, ever fresh. Everything is evolving and fall. The moment we, I mean, a tradition, a spiritual tradition is, we were talking about that with whom? I think yesterday. Well, with someone. We did a podcast with someone some of these days, and probably with Radha Madha Prabhu. And we were talking how a living tradition, I mean, a tradition is representing a reality. Now, we Gaudiya Vaishnavas, for example, we are trying to represent a reality. Mahaprabhu, Radha and Krishna, Bhakti, whatever. And that's an ever-evolving reality, right? Krishna is the all-attractive, but he's becoming more attractive at every moment. The love of the devotees in response is becoming more loving at every moment. Everything is exponentially unfolding at every moment. So a tradition that is represented in such an ever-evolving reality should be equally ever-evolving. If not, it's a disservice to the reality you are supposed to be representing. If I'm coming to you and I say, I will talk to you about an ever-evolving reality, and I do from a place of dogma and rigidity and closure, it's like, that's, you are not honoring your lineage. You are not honoring your ancestry. No, our challenge is to keep the pace with an ever-evolving reality. That's what Parampara is for. And as beautiful and as it is, all that our previous acharya said, and please understand what I'm saying, as beautiful as all that is, it's not enough. It's not enough in the sense, and I'm not saying anything to downplay any of what they say. I'm just saying, if any of them will be here now, they will be bringing some new contribution. They are not here, we are invited to bring that contribution ourselves. That's what Parampara is about. I mean, of course, you first learn the tradition, you first learn what was said before you, you honor that, and because you honor that, you become eventually able to bring your own contribution to the table. It's like we say before, whenever a new member joins a community, you are adding something to the community. Whenever someone joins a parampara, you are bringing your own contribution to the parampara. Like it or not, you are admitted or not, there's something expected from you. Your own gift has to be brought to the table. It may take years to take a particular shape, but I'm sure if Bhaktivinoda Thakur will be here, Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta, Prabhupada Srila Siddhartha Maharaj, Rupa Goswami, you name it, they were not referring us just back to the books they wrote or to the lectures they gave. They will be saying so much more because there is so much more to say, because reality keeps blooming. So you have to get the latest update, so to say. What's the latest news about the late blooming of reality? That's what keeps the whole of the spiritual world awakened and vibrant. So yeah, I will say that many times when someone will say, do not water down, and especially coming with a like pointing finger and like some type of intimidation tone, it's more the fear they have than, and of course they try to create fear in you because that's a projection of their own fear. And I'm not criticizing that person, whomever that person may be, maybe us, but just trying to understand it with some hopefully compassion that, yeah, sometimes we are afraid of what is new. That's in big part what's going on here. Most of us, all of us, or most of us, are afraid of newness to some degree or another, because newness is imply something unknown. And that implies jumping into something that I don't know. And generally, we prefer to stay what we know with the certainty. And there is a place for that, a big place for that, to be comforted in certainty and nourished in certainty and grounded in that. And at one point, you need to do your own hero's journey and confront the unknown and extract your own gifts from that liminal space and make your own contribution to the tribe, so to say. You may not be able to do that on day one. I totally get it. On year one, even on lifetime one of bhakti, so to say. But at one point, we should be gradually prepared and encouraged to reach that point. Even if in the beginning I have no capacity or clue how to do that, those who are guiding me, hopefully, are guiding me with that idea in mind. No? Like eventually, you think for yourself, you have your own criteria and discernment, your own offering to make. You can be, as Srila Prabhupada said, independently thoughtful people, right? He never say you have to become codependently non-thoughtful, whatever, robots. No, exactly the other way around. It may take time, I get it, but we should be careful not to weaponize some ideas. Yeah, philosophy can be watered down, but it doesn't mean that any attempt to bring something new is a watering down, because you can hammer that idea of watering down whenever you see something different from what you think is the only way possible. And the moment you think there's only one way possible, sorry to say, but you are watering down the whole thing. No? Because the moment we stop seeing a tradition as evolutionary and dynamic, that very moment we are stagnating the tradition, or we are stagnating ourselves. The essence of the tradition continues to evolve independently of us. But those who denounce publicly sometimes, you are watering down, you should keep things as they have been always, they are the ones who are watering down the whole thing, because they want to make a living, dynamic thing into a museum piece. But of course, it's too much for us to recognize that. So it's always easy to find some scapegoat and the enemy outside, right? Weak faith requires an enemy. So those will be my thoughts, Rasangi, which are
I
yours.
think that's so cool. Thank you so much. I think the word deviation comes in too. Deviating, and they're just so, but yet what we're learning now is like this ever expanding and this newness and not linear. It's like very
Yeah,
different.
but that's a tradition. That's what the tradition teaches, right? Tradition teaches this is not linear, this is expansive. That's traditional. I mean, to really be very orthodox, I mean, for me, my books about evolution and divine love is super orthodox, because it's for me it's all based on the original revelation, which is very dynamic. But sometimes we think that orthodoxy means be narrow-minded and rigid and blah blah blah. No. Orthodoxy means going to the source revelation and trying to ruminate on that, to do something with that. So that's interesting thing, right? Those who call themselves the Orthodox, and I'm following the thing very chaste, in a very chaste way, many of them are not very familiar with the actual tradition, so they misrepresent it. Now, it happened many times. They're like, Maharaj, how you dare to say that God is evolving? That's not part of the tradition. And I don't want to sound like I'm no the tradition. I just give an example. I said, oh, look at this quote. That's from the tradition. It says that Krishna is becoming more beautiful at every moment. And that's it. They don't know what to say. I'm not laughing at them. I'm just saying that sometimes we may have learned the tradition to some degree, and we develop like a excessive toxic certainty around certain dogma. So whatever challenges that, we think is a deviation, and we denounce it as such, so to reassure ourselves, I'm not a deviated one. Because of course, if I realize that the other thing that is different is not a deviation, probably that's mirroring back that I may be deviated. I may be getting it wrong. And sometimes we don't want to see that. We don't want to be confronted with that truth. Though we should. That's what we call progress. We grow by realizing, oh, I got it wrong. I mean, I've gone through that many times. It's not that I'm not going through that all the time. We will realize we had a partial understanding of something not broad enough, deep enough. We need another, probably a crisis sometimes, to expand our depth and breadth of vision. And that's how we keep learning, student forever, right? So, but also, yeah, being compassionate and understanding with everyone. Each one is in their own chapter of learning. So for each one of us, there may be a level of truth that still is too big for us. And we may feel threatened or uncomfortable, and we may prefer not to be fully confronted. Each one of us may have our corresponding version of that. So we should be generous with one another in that sense also. And not just all these orthodox ones, they think like that. I'm more broad and devout and dynamic. No, I have my own version of rigidity and narrow-mindedness and fear of the unknown that I have to be willing to confront. And when I do that, I have the next version, and so on and so forth. And that's how we grow. That's how we make progress, right? Hopefully we can normalize this instead of stigmatizing one another.
So one more thing, when you're talking about, when you're kind of preaching, so to speak, with
No,
someone,
no, no. Some other, find some other word, please.
oh yeah, I know. I know, I know. I said quotes, air quotes. You know what I mean?
Some
When you're
other
talking,
word.
when you're talking with someone
Okay,
and
that sounds good.
we're coming from that place, how could you bring them to the current to capture the spirit of a letter, instead of the letter of the law, the spirit of the law, right? We want the spirit of the tradition,
Amen.
not. So what could you say? Like, you already said a few things, but is there something that in general we can bring it back to kind of guide
What
that conversation?
just basically what comes to my mind is that, to be honest, you ask me, so from my personal side, I'm not so much someone who is trying to bring someone to any particular wave. So I'm not starting a conversation trying to take people to come here, think like me, convert to my creed, believe as I do, learn what I have to tell you, whatever, right? I try. I'm not saying I'm not doing that, but I'm trying not to do that. Let's put it that way. And as you say, I'm trying to talk to another person, which is not the same as, that's why I don't like the word preached, with all respect. Because also preaching is kind of, it may have had a meaning at the time and eventually took a different weight, and so I like to sit with other person and talk to the other person and learn from the other person. So I'm not trying to take the person anywhere. I'm just trying to be myself, allowing the other person to be himself, herself, and trusting that if we both approach a conversation with that openness, we will all both leave learning something and enriching each other, and that's enough for me. I don't care if the person ends up being initiating Gaudiya Vaishnavism or not, to be honest. I don't care at all. I don't need that to happen for me to be more secure about my own practice, right? If it happens for the right reasons, I celebrate that. And if it doesn't happen for the right reasons, I also celebrate that. So as long as things happen for the right reasons, there are reasons to celebrate. But for me, approaching a conversation and having communion and dialogue with someone, that's the important thing. Because if not in the name of preaching or in the name of sharing the message, and I have nothing against sharing the message, but from which place I'm sharing, how much I'm actually sharing and willing to receive as well, how much is just a monologue, how much is pyramidal, how much is one-on-one. Because many times in the name of preaching or something close to that, we are canceling all possibilities of dialogue. We are not talking to the other with one another. I'm talking to you, not with you. So many times we end up resorting to quote unquote preaching to not be open to actual conversations. And that's very tragic, because I'm not opening myself to be transforming conversation, because a true dialogue and conversation implies the willingness to listen, not only to open your mouth, to listen and to be transformed from what you are receiving from the other person. And that's why many people do not like that, and they prefer just to preach, in the sense of just to tell others what to do, how to think. This is the absolute truth, and here it is. Good luck. If you want to take it, take it. If not, something like that. Again, I'm not saying everyone is doing that, but sometimes that happens in one religious group or outside of religious groups. It can be a political group, a social, whatever, in a family. So for me, the important thing is showing up vulnerably to a conversation, openly and open to learn from one another. That's a basic humility of any human interaction. If not, I'm just starting a totalitarian regime of my own. I have nothing to listen and learn from anyone, and you are just supposed to listen to me and convert to my message. I mean, how far we are from the Nazi regime, from Mao, from Stalin, from whatever. So we can begin some micro versions of that at home, and that's how something more universal eventually happens, because one was already believing in that, and someone may expose that, and oh yeah, I'm going for that, and then suddenly you have a whole Holocaust over there, but that didn't happen overnight. It was not only the fault of Hitler, it was the many other people who subscribed to that. Because if all people will say, I don't care for this, what this crazy guy is saying, you wouldn't have had a Holocaust. So we have to be very careful what we are feeding, what belief systems we are feeding in our minds, because we maybe end up supporting something that can be terrible or embodying that ourselves, right? So that's it. Happy birthday, Resenki. That's my verbal birthday. As a Swami, I don't have much to give monetarily to buy anything. We are online, so there goes my little gift. And thank you for the gift of you to all of us as well.
No, I got it. Thank you so much. So much value, our association and these chats we have. So
Yeah.
much.
Speaking about chats, let's go one more time, a few more minutes before we conclude to our breakout rooms to churn together a little bit about these recent conversations and topics. And we'll see you back in a few minutes for our goodbye for this week. See you soon. Okay, there you are back. Welcome. Hoping you had some interesting time together. Those in the breakout rooms, those spending some individual contemplation time. And once again, deep gratitude for your presence, your gift of your presence, the gift of your attentions, of your sharings, of your questions, of your sincerity in the exploration. It's really a blessing to each one of us. So deep gratitude, and we'll be seeing each other next week. Same day, different time for me. I will be Netherlands, but same time as usual, just a little later, being in Europe, but looking forward to connecting this coming weekend for a new episode of The Journey. Pranam to all of you. Shriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Shri Hari Nam Sankirtan ki jai, Gaur Bhaktavrinda ki jai, Gaur Premanand Hari Hari bol, Om Purnamada Purnamidam, Purnat Purnamudachite Purnasya Purnamadaya, Purnamiva Vashishyate. Let completeness be the norm for the time being. Eventually we'll get to further thirst, and that will be the main reason for us to meet next weekend.